The hunt is on for the source of the coronavirus. Was it a natural leap from animal to human via another host animal, or was it a leak from the Wuhan Institute of Virology? To date, we don't know. And the answer is vitally important to a large swath of people and the Chinese and American governments. Early in the pandemic, we were heavily influenced to believe it was a natural emergence. The reason we were nudged in that direction was statements from two significant scientific groups, statements that, according to science journalist Nicholas Wade, were not at first hand examined as critically as they should have been. On February 19th, 2020, The Lancet published a statement that said, "We stand together to strongly condemn conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin." Wade says, contrary to that assertion, the idea that the virus might have escaped from the lab or a lab-invoked incident or accident, is not a conspiracy, it surely needed to be explored, not rejected out of hand. And he says, a defining mark of good scientists is that they go to great pains to distinguish between what they know and what they don't know. And by this criterion, the signatories of the Lancet letter were behaving as poor scientists. I invited Nicholas Wade to discuss his investigative work to have a conversation that matters about what we do and don't actually know about the source of the COVID-19 virus. Nicholas, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Evan.
This is an extraordinary piece that you've written. It's very detailed, and it looks at two competing theories about how the coronavirus came about. What was it that, first of all, prompted you to say, all right, this needs closer examination?
Well, I'd been following the issue for some time and noticed that the possibility of lab escape had been given no serious coverage in the mainstream media, despite the fact that it was obviously plausible. Wuhan Institute of Virology is right there in the city of Wuhan where the pandemic broke out. So it seemed to me that it was time to look carefully at the reason why people dismissed lab leak as a conspiracy theory. And as soon as I did so, it was immediately obvious that these two letters that you mentioned were full of holes, were asserting things that the authors could not possibly know, that they were misusing their expertise as scientists to assure the public of facts that may or may not have been true, and that neither letter was a sort of credible basis for dismissing lab leak.
Well, you also touch on the fact that credible scientists will go to great pains to demonstrate that they do not have a potential conflict. And in one of those letters, the author even said, "We do not have a conflict," but it turns out that they do.
Yes, the first letter, which appeared in The Lancet, turned out to have been orchestrated by Peter Daszak, who is the president of the EcoHealth Alliance in New York. And he receives a large grant from the National Institutes of Health that he then subcontracted to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So obviously, if there had been a leak from that lab, he would be potentially to blame for not having made sure the experiments were being conducted in safe conditions. So this was a glaring conflict of interest that he should have stated, that the editor of The Lancet should have brought to the attention of readers. In fact, no such declaration was made. And as you noted, the letter in The Lancet ended by saying, "We declare no conflict of interest." This is a quite outrageous way to treat the public.
Well, you also followed that up, and you see that there is a letter from Christian Anderson of Scribbs Research that also caused you to, dig further and raise questions for you.
Well, this is a very remarkable letter, and it plays a sort of central role in this whole sad story. This letter from Anderson and three other expert virologists is the most detailed presentation of the natural emergence theory. And it it starts out by saying that there is no way this virus could have been manipulated. Well, this is an obvious false assertion because there are many ways known to virologists in which you can manipulate viruses without leaving any traces of the manipulation. Serial passage is one of them. You just infect one animal after another with a virus, so which will, even if badly adapted to the animal in the first place, will end up being very well adapted to it, with natural selection having done all the heavy lifting. It adapts naturally. So that is one way, and there are others, of manipulating viruses without leaving any sign. So this letter from Christian Andersen and three colleagues was misleading from the start, and it continued on that way. And one of the most remarkable recent events in this story is that we now know from a trove of emails sent to Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in Washington, that he received a letter from Christian Andersen on January 31st of last year. And this letter said that Andersen and his three colleagues had taken their first look at the virus, and they had all concluded unanimously that this virus was not a product of evolution. In other words, that it was man-made. So the next day, as we also know from the emails, there was a meeting between three of the four virologists and two of their chief funders, that is Dr. Fauci of the NIAID and Jeremy Farrar of the Wellcome Trust in London, a very sort of rich philanthropy that supports lots of biomedical research. So it's very likely that these virologists, dependent on payments from these two men, would have listened rather carefully to whatever views they may have expressed at that meeting, the results of which have not been revealed. They were censored from the emails. Shortly after that meeting, Dr. Andersen and his colleagues execute a 180-degree turn. They change their mind completely on the basis of no new evidence that they've yet made aware to anyone. And they wrote the second letter in the Nature Medicine, the one saying natural emergence was the only possibility. This looks very bad, and there is no real defense of it.
So despite what you know about the positioning of researchers, the way that they're asserting that it was a natural selection, you went out to examine what's the possibility of it being an accidental escape from the lab versus natural occurrence. Why did you remain so open-minded to both? And at the end of your article, you say there isn't enough proof to state with a declaration one or the other. Let's first of all take a look at the lab example. What is some of the evidence that would suggest that it is a lab leak?
Well, I think I should say, first of all, that we have two very plausible hypotheses on the table. A natural emergence is very plausible because of all the many previous epidemics that have jumped from animals to humans. And lab leak is plausible because there's been a long history of viruses leaking from labs. There's about sort of one leak a year on average that we know about, and probably many others that we don't. So you've got two plausible hypotheses, and you have no direct evidence for either. There's no direct evidence that COVID-19 actually was a naturally emergent virus as its many predecessors were. There's no evidence, direct evidence, that it escaped from the lab. So I think one should sort of keep that firmly in mind, and that is the reason why one cannot reach a definitive conclusion. But what you can do, I think, is take the available evidence and ask, well, which of these two hypotheses explains it better? And I think for several reasons, the lab leak hypothesis on present evidence explains things rather better than the natural emergence hypothesis.
What is key in that evidence that makes you lean towards that direction? But at the same time, also, what prevents you from making a definitive assertion that actually is the source?
Well, if I could take those questions in reverse order.
Okay.
What we need as definitive evidence is to get access to the records of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, to learn what viruses they were working on, what experiments they were doing, and what their results were, all of which have been sealed off by the Chinese authorities, who have also closed down as early as September 2019 the main database for bat viruses. So that's why we can't say anything definitively, and that's the evidence we need probably to make a definitive pronouncement. So, as to why lab leak seems more plausible to me, one reason is the simple fact of geography. The Wuhan is the center of the pandemic, as well as housing the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So the epidemic broke out right on the doorstep of China's leading center for the study of coronaviruses. So that's certainly something that lab leak hypothesis can explain with the greatest of ease. Much harder to explain on natural emergence. Not impossible, but it's very difficult to sort of get the virus to break out somewhere else in China, and then without leaving any trace for an infected person, without infecting his family or anyone else, to jump on a train to Wuhan and then start infecting people there. I mean, it just is a little strained. Another piece of evidence, much easier to explain on lab leak, is the fact that from the start, the virus was very well adapted to humans. Now, the previous SARS virus, SARS-1, took a long time to adapt, first to its intermediate host, civets, which are sold in wet markets, and then to humans. So you can trace in minute detail that it makes sort of like five mutations to get good at attacking civets, and so another 10 to be able to attack humans just a little, and another 10, I think 25 of these mutations in all, before it becomes a real serious human pathogen. If you look at that, if you look to find a similar process in SARS-2, it's not there. Right from the beginning, it's a very good attacker of human cells. Very easy to explain on lab leak, because we know that Dr. Shi, the chief coronavirologist from Wuhan, was working with coronaviruses. She was using them to infect humanized mice. So these are mice genetically engineered to carry the human-type cells in their respiratory tracts. So if you grow viruses in humanized mice, they get to be very good at attacking humans. So easy to explain on lab leak. Very hard to explain on natural emergence. And a third point, which is more technical, is that there is a very important element of the SARS-CoV-2 virus called the furin cleavage site, which does not exist in other viruses of its family, which are called sarbecoviruses. No other sarbecovirus has this furin cleavage site. So the usual way in which viruses acquire sort of new genetic properties is by exchanging material with other viruses in their family. What they cannot acquire is some genetic property their family does not possess. So hard to explain how, on the natural emergence theory, how SARS-2 came by its furin cleavage site. Not impossible, but it's yet another difficult thing for the natural emergence theory to explain.
I also know that in your article you talked about the fact that it does happen that there are researchers who become infected by the viruses that they're working on, and when they're doing so, there is no vaccine to protect them, and that this is known, and it's not an unusual occurrence for that researcher to become infected by that virus.
Well, that's right. We know from an interview that Dr. Peter Daszak gave just before the pandemic broke out, that Dr. Shi had been working with these viruses, trying to get them to infect human cells, and that there was no vaccine or monoclonal therapy that worked against the viruses. So we know, therefore, that she and her co-workers were unvaccinated and therefore at greater risk, which is especially pertinent because they were working in very low-level safety conditions. They were working in what's called BSL 2 safety, which is just the sort of second grade up. It's sort of roughly equivalent to the safety conditions you'd find in a dentist's office. It is not appropriate for containing a really infectious coronavirus.
They should have been working in a BSL 4 environment? Should they not have been? But it's my understanding that it's, and it's probably not unusual for human nature to say, it's so cumbersome, it's so difficult to do, let's just let's take an easier path. But that, of course, leads to the possibility of infection and leak.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, no virologist likes to work in BSL-4 level conditions. It's very expensive. It's very tedious. Everything sort of takes 10 times as long. Now, that is why, and here this is not Dr. Xi's fault, the international rules for working with coronaviruses were that if you're working with the SARS-1 virus or MERS, those the ones that caused the two previous epidemics, you had to work in BSL level 3 labs. If you're working with any other kind of coronavirus, even ones closely related to SARS-1, as Dr. Xi was doing, it was okay to work in BSL level 2. So Dr. Xi was following the international rules. It's just those rules clearly were totally inappropriate.
It would be really easy for a viewer right now to say, okay, I'm going to turn off and go, you've convinced me that this is a lab leak. But you say, we cannot say that with certainty. What's the case that suggests that it could be a natural occurrence?
The only evidence for natural occurrence is that many previous viruses have taken that route, have jumped from animals to people. So it's an obvious possibility. It's just that the Chinese government has every possible incentive to establish that that was the case. So presumably for the last year, until the WHO commission visited Beijing in February of this year, the Chinese government had been testing every animal in sight to see if they could find the intermediary host and beyond that, the sort of source bat population. Yet when the WHO commission arrived in Beijing, the Chinese authorities have absolutely no evidence to give them in favor of natural emergence. So I think natural emergence, sort of, it has to remain on the table. It's just that it was very plausible at first, but as each month goes by with not a shred of evidence in support, it has sort of waning probability. And you know, I think at some stage, people have to say, well, we need to reach a resolution of some kind here, and we're going to decide that on the balance of present evidence and given the fact of unchanging Chinese stonewalling, it looks very much like lab leak is the answer here. And unless you, China, start being more cooperative to help us prevent something of this kind ever happening again, we're going to have to decide that failing new evidence, that lab leak is what occurred here. And we're not at that point yet, but it seems to me that's the way things are pointing.
The consequences of making that assertion and declaring it as being true are significant to a wide range of institutions and governments. If we take a look at the work of EcoHealth and also even Scripps Research, if this is the case, they have to be very concerned about how that is going to impact them moving forward and on up through NIH, the American government and the Chinese governments. This is very, very important that we get to the bottom of this, the source of the coronavirus.
Well, I certainly agree. And since you've mentioned the US government, there's a very interesting sort of face-saving formula that might help here to sort of elicit the information we need. And that is to say, well, the American government supported this very dangerous research on Chinese territory, and research that seems like it was not properly supervised by the American funder. The Chinese side, you let this virus escape. So maybe there's enough blame here to go around for both governments. And under that sort of umbrella, then it might be possible for the Chinese to be a little more forthcoming as to what actually they were up to and how this terrible accident occurred. I don't say that's likely to happen, but I think it's a possibility the Chinese might start to consider, given that this thing is going to be an albatross hung around their necks in perpetuity, unless they help the rest of the world find some resolution.
How hopeful are you that that will happen?
Well, I'm not hopeful right now. I think a lot more things have to happen. I think we need commissions of scientists and others and intelligence agencies in Western countries to all look at this and all come to their own conclusions. But I think if enough of them conclude along the lines that we've just been discussing, that although there's no direct proof of either hypothesis, the balance of circumstantial evidence favors lab leak. If they all start to come to that conclusion, then the Chinese are going to see the rest of the world is aligned against them in supposing that their lab was the source of this terrible pandemic that has now killed 4 million people. And if China takes the rest of the world's goodwill as something that it values, then at that point, its calculus might be, well, let's fess up on this and say we did have a lab escape. We're terribly sorry. Here's what happened. We'll do our best to make amends. Now, I don't say that's likely. I think in time one can imagine the circumstances in which it might be more probable than it is today.
The challenging part for me, and I'm sure that anybody who has especially been directly affected and lost a loved one as a result of this coronavirus, is any explanation that somehow comes around and supports the lab leak theory, they're going to be very hollow words, because you're going to say the consequences of this directly are so severe, and I have nobody that I can turn to and say, look at what you've done to my life.
Well, I think that's right, except that if we do decide it's lab leak, you know, there has to be a very big reckoning of some kind. I mean, starting with the whole idea that underlay this research of going out into nature and aggressively beating the bushes for the kind of viruses that might make the leap to humans and bringing them back to our labs and saying, oh, we can safely hand them in our labs while we figure out, you know, what's going to be the next spillover and take steps to prevent it. This was the whole rationale for this kind of work. It seems to me this whole approach to zoonosis, to animal-caused pandemics, is something that has to be rethought from top to bottom, because obviously, given the fact that no lab is escape-proof, it's just very rash to bring these labs into your lab. Someone has compared it to looking for a gas leak with a lighted candle, and that's what we seem to have done in this case. Beyond that, there may be repercussions on the whole scientific enterprise as a whole. I mean, this is scientific hubris of the highest order, of believing we could handle a sort of recognized danger safely, and yet we've failed to do so with disastrous results. I think there are going to be lots of rethinkings that might in the end give some solace to the people you mentioned who have lost their loved ones.
Yes, it's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds in the short term and in the long term. And I thank you for your remarkable work, the investigative work that you've done to go into such great detail to give us a better understanding of what the possible source of COVID-19 has been. Thank you very much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks so much.